Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Emily, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Regulating Free Speech and Campaign Finance. Where should we draw the lines? I'd now like to turn the time over to our moderator today, Royce Van Tassel.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I want to especially thank the Hinckley Institute of Politics for hosting this event. We're pleased to have, I think, what will be a very vigorous and rich debate between Bill Maurer of the Institute for Justice and Representative Greg Hughes of Draper. Bill Maurer is the executive director of the Washington chapter of the Institute for Justice. He is a well-known scholar on First Amendment issues, has litigated before the Supreme Court and won before the Supreme Court on First Amendment issues. I will confess that the Institute for Justice is one of my favorite organizations in the country, just as Representative Hughes is one of my favorite legislators. So the basic topic, and I guess I should note that we have in the back a primer on the broad issues that we'll be discussing today. These are serious constitutional and practical politics questions. But what we want to explore is, you have a lot of questions about campaign finance reform. You have questions about free speech and free association. We've obviously here in Utah seen a lot of heat and discussion over those issues, first with Representative Brad Dawes' race a couple of years ago. Frankly, even before that, in Representative Hughes' own race, 4 or 5 years ago?
2008.
So 6 years ago. But most recently, obviously, in the discussion over the Attorney General's office. Representative Hughes put together a bill last year that was designed to create greater transparency, greater disclosure. There were questions raised at the time by the Institute for Justice and other organizations around the country about the extent to which his bill, HB 43, which ultimately passed, may violate some constitutional principles, specifically free association and free speech. And so the Institute for Justice contacted the Taxpayers Association and asked them if we might be able to help. We have felt that the best way to help would be to facilitate a dialogue, which brings us here today. So without further ado, I'll turn the time over to Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Royce. And Mr. Maurer, thank you for being here. If the legislative process, for those that have been interns or who've participated, Emily was an intern last year. Worked very hard as an intern, was my intern, so inherently she had to keep running the whole time. You get to see an amazing process. They say it's like you don't want to see bills or laws or sausage made, but I think you would. I think you'd love to see and appreciate the kind of dialogue, the kind of debate that it goes on when we consider bills and legislation. Contrary to what maybe the perception is, I mean, there's a lot of disagreement, but I think if you look at that, the far majority of bills that are presented, when lawmakers of any party work hard, communicate with their colleagues, come to committee prepared, good policy passes and bad policy doesn't. And so it's a great opportunity to have this open dialogue, and I am wholly unqualified to argue or to debate someone with your resume because I'm not an attorney. I'm a policymaker. So I'm going to speak to you from a perspective of a policymaker. I have some great Ledge Research has given me great precedent and Supreme Court rulings that would point to the constitutionality of this bill, and we can crawl around in the deep grass on some of these, some of its nuances in terms of what legal what definitions of legal standards are satisfied, and we can do that. But I want to share with you why I ran the bill, what this policy is meant to accomplish, and why it's important to our election process here in the state of Utah to have the kind of transparency that this bill creates. I only have 7 minutes, so I'm trying to hurry here. Before I even get to there, just let me give you some of my background as a policymaker. 1988, I was from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I worked on the Bush-Coyle 88 presidential campaign in the state office. So that's where I cut my teeth in politics. That was the last year that a Republican won the state of Pennsylvania in a presidential election, and it was an incredible experience for me. Planted seeds that today I wouldn't be here without some of the great experiences I had to start off. I've worked on congressional campaigns. I've helped mayoral candidates. I've spent a considerable amount of time as a campaign worker. So I feel like, in addition to being a policymaker, working within a campaign infrastructure and being part of that effort to inform the public, to look for people to get involved, to vote, to make votes of conscience, I've been part of that beyond just my experience as a policymaker. And I've been in the legislature. I was elected in 2002. 2003 was my first session. So I'm walking in next week into my 12th session. And the time has flown. But I just want to give you kind of the picture of where I come from and what my perspectives are. I'm going to try this power. I hate PowerPoints, but there's some things I have to, and I know this is for a listening audience, so I'm going to do my best to describe what we're going to see on the screen. But let me go. From my earliest experience, you have campaign contributors that contribute to campaigns. It is the mother's milk of a campaign. You have to have resources to communicate your message. And contributors to your effort is the only way this really happens. We have, in our most recent election, very interested parties who wanted to get involved in this process. They wanted to help Attorney General John Swallow, or candidate John Swallow. They wanted to put their resources into a race to help, frankly, influence the outcome. Here are the opportunities that you have under traditional process to get involved. Now, I'm a candidate, and when I seek to run an election, you'll see those political campaigns, that's me, and that's my opponent in a race. And what we have to do is there's strict laws and disclosure laws that everyone who contributes to my campaign says who they are. I disclose who the contributor is and how much they give. Now, in Utah, we don't have caps on our campaign contributions. And I think that's important. If you look at the federal system, you'll find that those caps, in my opinion, have created circuitous routes for money to find their way into campaigns. And the relevance of that money or why that money is being contributed could be, and I think is, lost on the public as they're making these decisions. So in our system, we do not have caps, but we have full disclosure, meaning we're not going to tell people how much they can give, but we certainly want to know who's giving and who's participating in this process. And we think that makes for a healthy and transparent process. If I don't want to give to a campaign, I can give to a political issues committee. I can give to a political action committee, PACs. You've heard the term before. These are very large, and these are very successful endeavors. You'll find employment associations. Every year we make laws. And if you don't care about government, government still cares about you, or stakeholders care about what you do. And so some people think that PACs are these dirty lobbyists, but if it's your profession or your interest, this is just good old-fashioned grassroots advocacy. So it depends on where you're at in this process, how you feel about the kind of lobbying that goes on or the kind of political activity that happens, and who's representing that. We have great examples of political action committees here in the state, large and small. We have teachers who associate, Utah Education Association. We have realtors. We have all kinds that participate in this process. And it's one that when you do this, there are disclosures that are given. We've changed the law in the legislature where we do more real-time disclosures. We used to have benchmark dates. Now when you deposit a disclosure and a campaign account, you have 30 days to disclose that in real time to the state elections office. And we think that with technology, that makes all the sense in the world. Again, creates greater transparency. These entities that in some cases, and we get this information, by the way, by a House investigation that occurred into the practices and some of the events that happened around the election of John Swallow and some of the money that was moved. Some of these, it was said in testimony, some of these entities from around the country, these are not Utah, necessarily Utah entities, wanted to get involved in John Swallow's race. Some of them went so far as to contribute directly to John Swallow's campaign. What we found is that those campaign contributions were returned, and instead it was suggested that these entities give to this Paparola Government Education Association, which is a 501c4. So what we found is over $450,000 sent to that 501c4. Now, 501c4s, it's a mechanism of the IRS. It's not really a campaign organization. It does not require disclosure of who gives to that organization. So as each of these entities began to send their money in anticipation of a political campaign, there was no obligation and there was no law that required them to disclose who they were. So you have, those are the contributors. 2 minutes here, right. Okay, hurrying up. Contributors give to the Paparola government. And what you're going to see, and I'm going to hustle here, is you're going to see, some would say, dollars shifted. Some would say dollars laundered or washed. You can use whatever vernacular you would like for what you're seeing on this screen. But what you ultimately see is that there are campaign commercials, campaign flyers, that are going out to influence the outcome of an election. The campaign fundraiser, or the fundraiser for this, it's been determined and it was found through the investigation, was the candidate for the Attorney General's office, John Swallow. He was the one raising the dollars that found its way into this 501c4. This is the slide I wanted to show. This comes from the slide that the House investigation showed House members. You see the bright yellow right there? That's the process I described where people disclose who they are and how much they're giving into a campaign process. You see an obscured section there, and what that is people give to another PAC. That PAC collects the contributions, and then they send it up to maybe another PAC or another campaign so that you don't see those individual contributors, but you see that they aggregate or pull that money together and send it up. At least that part, the obscured part, is still there's a disclosure requirement there. But it's this hidden part that I got really worried about. And I didn't know the extent when we ran the bill. I'd been in enough campaigns to see when I see a political action committee with one sole contributor and you have no idea the context or the relevance behind who's giving to that one group, I became worried that that would be something that would be continually manipulated and used more and more in our process. And you could have the effect of seeing more of the money, not in the transparent section or even the obscured section, but seeing more and more money find its way into this, what I would call an underbelly, and see more of that money being used to be the sole funders of PACs to get around disclosure. So again, in the spirit of transparency, not limiting expenditures, which again, this bill went through constitutional review by our attorneys. This bill is constitutional and will stand a court challenge if it came. We had to have a process where we create a level playing field. A level playing field that allows everyone to know who it is talking to them. So, tying it up, I know I'm done here. My point here is that when you, in the Supreme Court and the Citizens United, and if we get wonkish here, I can give you the quote from the Supreme Court case. The Supreme Court recognized that it's important to know who's speaking to you when you have freedom of speech. You need to know who the person is. You know, elections aren't seances. You don't get landed from places you don't understand messages that look to influence how you would vote without having the relevance behind who's doing it. Now, this is what's important. I just showed you a list of people from one particular industry, okay, the payday loan industry. In their attack ads, the ads to Sean Reyes as a candidate for AG, Representative Brad Daw in his House race, never once is payday lending ever discussed as an issue in that campaign. You'll see the Obama image and Brad Daw's head is with the surgical hat on or whatever. They talk about health care. They talk about other issues. If you knew who the contributors were and who had paid for that ad, it would take you 15 minutes to look up what bills Brad Daw might have run that have to do with the payday lending association or their industry to understand why they're spending so much money in that race. But without that critical information, you think someone's mad about health care. You think people have issues in this campaign that at the end of the day, when this investigation followed the money trail, it wasn't what this race was really about. So anyway, transparency and sunshine is a good process in our campaigns and elections. It's why we ran the bill and why I'm here today defending it. Thanks.
Take as long as you want.
Okay. Sorry, I have to close this.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you for to the Hinckley Institute. Thank you to Royce. And thank you to Representative Hughes to be willing to discuss this important topic as Utah and the rest of the country moves on with trying to decide exactly what are the rules that are going to be in play when people choose the policies and people that compromise public policy in the United States. People assume that disclosure is a relatively benign and light-handed form of regulation of political speech. In fact, Representative Hughes alluded to that this is not as heavy as contribution or expenditure limitations, and that it doesn't stop anybody from speaking. And it provides voters with useful information that they use to make better decisions in politics. Unfortunately, the one question that people do not ask after that listing those assumptions is any of that actually true? Unfortunately, courts and legislatures, including the Citizens United Court and the Buckley versus Vallejo Court, have simply accepted the idea that disclosure provides useful information, that it has no harm to political discourse, and that it is something that helps create transparency instead of obscuring where money comes from. But they rarely look at whether the costs of disclosure outweigh the benefits, if any, to disclosure, and they rarely engage in a cost-benefit analysis of the regime that they particularly are interested in. In other words, First Amendment rights, fundamental First Amendment rights, are being regulated on the basis of assumptions. And the reality is that disclosure is actually probably one of the most harmful forms of regulation to political discourse in the United States. It achieves almost nothing that the opponents or its proponents claim. The first harm that disclosure costs is actually fairly obvious. It creates harassment or the potential for harassment. People oftentimes say, I'm very much in favor of disclosure. I believe in political disclosure and transparency and openness in government. They change their tune, though, when you describe to them that the disclosure regime is actually nothing more than a government-mandated and maintained database of citizen political activity that the government collects, puts your name and address, and oftentimes your name and address of your employer, on a database accessible to anybody in the United States or across the world with a computer, including your coworkers, your relatives, your union shop steward, your bosses, and, of course, your friendly neighborhood identity thief. And this has, in the past, in fact, led to harassment of people for engaging in political activity by donating to unpopular or controversial candidates or issues. Including some members of the LDS Church who received harassment threats and economic boycotts because of the LDS Church's support of Proposition 8 in California. And far from fighting corruption, disclosure can actually help enable corruption. It cuts down on the amount of transaction costs that it takes for a potentially corrupt legislator to identify who will be willing to support them and who they need to punish, who's giving to their opponents. Richard Nixon would not need an enemies list today. He could simply look up his list of enemies on the FEC website. Another thing that the proponents of disclosure relatively or usually do not examine are the actual financial and administrative costs of disclosure. And for small organizations, grassroots organizations, these costs can be staggering, and it often is sufficient to drive them out of the political process altogether. Small organizations cannot afford the lawyers, bookkeepers, and accountants needed to be able to comply with many of these disclosure responsibilities. And so it raises the cost of political participation, and we actually don't know exactly how high it raises the cost, because it creates a negative. People simply look at the cost and the potential for getting in trouble, engaging in something that is as complicated as filling out an IRS form, and simply decide, it's not worth it, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to participate in politics. And so small speakers get driven out of the political process, leaving the field to precisely the type of people like the payday lenders. Does anybody believe that if we have a rigorous and extremely intrusive disclosure regime here in the state of Utah, that the payday lenders will not have an opportunity to have their voice heard? On the flip side, nobody ever asks, actually, whether all of this is worth it. Does disclosure actually achieve any of its goals? Academic research suggests that most citizens do not use or access the info, the information that is demanded to be disclosed. Let me ask the audience, actually. How many people here know where to access financial disclosure or contribution information on political contributions in the state of Utah? So that's 5 out of, I guess, 30, maybe 25 people. How many have actually looked at that information when they've been making a decision about who to vote for? 3. So, and this is a fairly sophisticated audience, I would think. You work, or at least are involved in, an institute for politics. Imagine if you were a sanitation worker. Would you be looking at that information to be able to determine exactly what to do with it? Even the media does not make an extensive use of disclosure, not as much as one would think. And there's no evidence that disclosure actually produces better informed voters. It actually can produce less informed voters, because it creates an incentive for people to simply bypass analysis of a particular position or a particular candidate and resort to a purely ad hominem decision about whether they're going to support or oppose something based purely on the motives of the people funding it. It actually increases the opportunity for people to stay uninformed about policy and politics. I could go on, but the ultimate point here is that this kind of cost-benefit analysis almost never occurs in the legislative process, and it also almost never occurs in the legal process either, unfortunately. Instead, what happens is that legislators react to events, they pass a law, and they move on without worrying about implementation, the burdens of compliance, or if the law actually accomplishes its goals. But these laws touch upon our fundamental First Amendment rights. They need to be very carefully considered before anybody passes them and anybody supports them. And they have to be analyzed with the idea of, ultimately, do they interfere with our fundamental First Amendment rights of free speech and free association? And unfortunately, I believe that HB 43 is exactly that kind of law. It was passed in reaction to events, and it didn't really look into exactly what were going to be the costs of compliance. And in fact, HB 43 is, I would believe, is one of the most expansive and intrusive disclosure laws in the history of this country. Not just now, but ever. And it is almost certainly unconstitutional under applicable Tenth Circuit precedent and United States Supreme Court precedent. Quite simply, HB 23 turns every corporation that spends money, more than $750, in Utah politics into a political action committee. And they have to report the names and addresses of each person that has given more than $50 to the corporation, unless the donor specifically opts out. The donor means anybody, and the term donor means anybody that has given money, including a fee, due, or membership assessment for less than adequate consideration. I have to admit, even though I do practice in this area, I have no idea what that means. I simply do not understand what giving something for less than adequate consideration to a corporation is in terms of political speech. And the law requires the corporation to actually inform the donor that they may have to, that their information may be disclosed, and that it may be used for political purposes. In other words, the government has created a message. And that message, it has told corporations that if you engage in politics, we have a message, you have to deliver it to people that you ordinarily would not include this message in your communications. The government is, in essence, dictating what corporations will say to their members and to their contributors. The best part about it is if anybody screws all of this up, there are criminal penalties. Not civil penalties, not a fine, but criminal penalties. The breadth of this law is truly outstanding. For many corporations, $750 is an infinitesimal amount of their annual budget. To Apple or Microsoft or any other organization of that size, $750 is what one office spends on non-dairy creamers. But if they engage in politics in Utah, they have to report that to the lieutenant governor. By the way, that's who has the information about contributions, financial contributions, is the lieutenant governor's website here in the state of Utah. And they have to, that spending of $750, which can be, you know, 1/100th or 1/1000th of the corporation's actual activities, has to be reported to the government. And it has to report all the people who donate $50. So the NRA, Planned Parenthood, the Nature Conservancy, and organizations that have memberships like the LDS Church and the Catholic Church have to report all donors of $50 from across the world. There is no limitation that the donors have to be from Utah. It is $50 from anybody across the world. For organizations like those, and like Amnesty International, they have to report the names of people who donated in England. There's also no analysis about what people are going to do or actually use this massive information for. This is going to create an enormous amount of information about financial activities that people not only will not access, but if they did access, they wouldn't be able to distinguish what it means. Partially because whether you are classified as a political donor depends on what the corporation does with the money. If I donate to the Nature's Conservancy, I live in Seattle, if I give to them because I like animals, and I give $51 to them, then they spend $751 in the state of Utah on some political activity, I'm listed as a Utah political donor. I may have absolutely no interest whatsoever in what's going on in Utah. Don't care. And not only that, I'm now being reported to the people of the state of Utah as a Utah political donor without me ever knowing it.
We need to wrap up.
Sure. So these are just some of the problems with HB 43. Actually, I could go on a bit further. I do appreciate Representative Hughes' willingness to discuss the portions of the law and consideration and willingness to debate it. For right now, HB 43 encompasses all that is wrong with the current donor regime and disclosure regime and actually exacerbates it to an almost unimaginable amount.
Thank you. I have a question for each of them that I figure we'll start the discussion with, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience if you have them. For Representative Hughes, certainly the tradition of anonymous anonymity in Utah or American politics has very deep roots. Perhaps the most famous anonymous political person in American history is Publius, who wrote, as did many of the day's pamphleteers, under his own pseudonym, instead of being known as Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. He wrote under the name Publius. In what ways would HB 43 be a problem? Would that have changed that? To Bill, you talk about this being a cost-benefit analysis that legislators and the courts have not engaged in, and yet your presentation suggested a sense that these kinds of disclosure would probably or should never be required. And I'm curious, is it an all-or-nothing? And if it isn't an all-or-nothing, what kinds of disclosure requirements might be more appropriate?
Royce, great question. And I hope as you ask questions of us, we can get into some of these things, because I think there's some good discussion that could be had on how this bill is described. To that end, if you are an education association, you are a nonprofit, and you would like to discuss the politics of our time, I read a book in the 90s from Anonymous, and that still exists today. There is all kinds of opportunities to have that Anonymous authorship, but if you're writing those or sending those flyers, you've gone beyond, I think, the Federalist Papers. You've gone beyond some of the things that we have pointed to in terms of Anonymous contribution to political discourse, and now you're electioneering, and now you're engaged in politics. And I think there's a big difference there. I think that, so that's the answer to your question, but I got more.
Well, I think from my standpoint, I'm a bit of a First Amendment absolutist. I happen to agree with Justice Hugo Black that when the founders wrote no law in the First Amendment, they actually meant no law. And so my idea with HB 43 is we scrap it altogether, that the idea that people cannot take into account the fact that some speech may be anonymous and contribute that into their analysis, I think is somewhat patronizing. And a good way to look at it is, do people take speech on the internet more seriously when the person signs their name to it, or when it's some anonymous troll blogger that just is spewing nonsense? People are able to take this information, the fact that speech has been made anonymously, into account when deciding whether the idea is a good one or whether this is a person that should be listened to. But if we had to have some sort of disclosure regime, there's ways to improve HB 43 that would make it less problematic from a First Amendment standpoint. First is that the monetary threshold is ridiculously low. So, as I mentioned, $750 is almost nothing. It probably costs $750 to put this event on. That's a bunch of campaign flyers and yard signs. That's really low. And in fact, the Tenth Circuit has struck down a disclosure regime that was based on $1,000. And also, the other thing, too, on the other side of that, is that $750, reporting what corporations spend $750 in an election, provides almost no useful information to Utah voters. So the second thing I think that would be helpful would be to include a major purpose requirement in the law. All the organizations that Representative Hughes was pointing out, their major purpose appeared to have been engaging in political speech, not producing computers, not urging reform of abortion rights or gay marriage. They were engaged in actually, their major purpose was the actual election or defeat of candidates. And the U.S. Supreme Court has used the major purpose test in the past as a way to distinguish who can be regulated and who cannot when it comes to political activity. And in the Tenth Circuit, in which Utah sits, they not only have a major purpose test, they have the major purpose test. It has to be the organization's major purpose to engage in political speech. Third, one of the other things I think would do a lot to mitigate some of the potential for harassment in this would be to not have the address of donors, of individual donors, listed on a database. I know people who are vehemently concerned about identity theft, and they are also vehemently concerned about the fact that they don't want people knowing their address just in general. And there are laws that protect the fact, information such as what movies you rented, your vote. There's all sorts of laws that protect information about you and your activities. There's no reason why the government must mandate your street address when it comes to something as controversial as political positions and political candidates.
Representative Hughes.
Hey, I just want to clarify a couple things as this bill's been described. Some of the vagueness that's pointed out. This bill, HB 43, did not create many of the standards that you see. The $750 threshold for corporations' involvement was statute and was law of the land. That wasn't created in the bill. The description of what would trigger that was already established law and wasn't addressed or changed in HB 43. The part of HB 43 that is different is that it does require that if you are going to give to a 501c4, a nonprofit, that it be disclosed to the donor that those contributions could be used for a political purpose. And if it is, you have the option right there to opt in or out. If you opt in with your contribution and you would like that to be used to influence campaigns and elections, then eyes wide open, you will be disclosed. But if you opt out of that, and I understand that this does create a administrative cost, but if you would like to be a member of these nonprofits, but you would not like to see your dollars used specifically for the purpose of influencing campaigns and elections, you can give to those charitable organizations and never have your name listed anywhere. But if you want to contribute and you know that the purpose is to influence a campaign election, you saw an infrastructure that the state has created to do that. And my comment about cost-benefit analysis is I want that cost-benefit analysis. I'm a candidate. There is a process that every campaign, every PAC, and every PIC has to go through to follow the law and disclose who their contributors are and how much they're giving. There are addresses given. On the federal level, you have to list your occupation. If what is being said here today is true, and this bill is an affront to our constitutional protections, I'm going to tell you, everyone in here, that's the same Constitution that protects you. And you have a right to be involved in this process, whether you want to be a part of a charitable organization or you just like a candidate and you want to help them and you want to see them be successful. Whatever standard we've created, it ought to be the level playing field. And if it's true that this cost-benefit analysis makes disclosure of any kind in political activity untenable, then we should all have that opportunity. We should not have a system where everybody's playing by one set of rules of disclosure and then have a process there with eyes wide open, knowing that those dollars would go for a political purpose and granting. And it's not just anonymity, because on the face it didn't say on the flyer anonymous. It said it says the proper role of government, education association. How about Motherhood and Apple Pie Association? Who thinks that that's an uncredible source? As has been pointed out, we're getting a lot of information. We're trying to compute the information as we receive it. Worse than anonymous, there are names being thrown out to the public that you draw certain conclusions from that might not be the case. So I think that those constitutional arguments wholly ought to apply to all of us. And if they don't, there ought to be a set of rules that we all play by. But specific to the bill, I think you can enjoy contributions to nonprofits and not find yourself within that disclosure requirement, and only if you'd like to do what PACs do, PICs do, contributions to candidates do, then you ought to be playing by those same rules.
Let's go to some questions from the audience. I know some of you, I assume that there will be some good questions.
Just state your name and a little bit about yourself.
Disclosure. We need to know.
Uh-oh, this is horrible disclosure, right? My name is Max Miller, and I am a member of the board of the Utah Taxpayers Association, and I have been a lawyer for 40-something years. My question is does the Institute for Justice contemplate a lawsuit challenging this?
We are not currently actively investigating a lawsuit into this particular bill. That doesn't mean that we do not find, or this particular law, that doesn't mean that we do not find there to be, as I mentioned, some significant constitutional concerns with this law.
We have another question in the back.
My name's Tanner Aist. I'm pre-dental here. I don't know basically anything other than what I've heard today. But I really want to disagree with everything you say. Just
that's okay. It happens.
Yeah.
I'm used to this. It's okay.
But I can't. That's my problem. So, Bill, my question is, like, I understand the issues that we have with the low spending limits, with the out-of-state people donating, we have opting out and all that. What could we do to help regulate things so we don't have people like the Koch brothers buying political parties? What can we do to keep people with those higher agendas with billions of dollars from funding all of this and stopping this?
I guess I would...
To you as well.
I guess my response to that is, why would you want to stop it? The First Amendment applies to the Koch brothers as well as to anybody else in this room. And it's not the government's role, or it's not the proper role of the government, to decide who's speaking too much and who's speaking too little, and to turn on the voices of the people that it believes are unduly influencing political speech, and turn up the voices of those they believe, not speaking sufficiently loud enough. Because if you give the government the ability to determine who's being too influential, oftentimes the government will simply decide that the people who are being too influential, who are being unduly influential, are the people who are opposing the government. And I think it's a very, very dangerous idea that we have to stop people from engaging in politics because we're concerned that they may be too influential, that people may listen to them too much. And that was one of the concerns I had with Representative Hughes' presentation, was that, you know, he had all these arrows and charts and things all leading to a bunch of political ads. That's political speech. Political speech is what the First Amendment is all about. The idea that at the end of the day, a bunch of payday lenders spent some money and ended up talking about health care meant that people got to hear a message about health care, that voters got to hear information about health care. The fact that it may have been insincere doesn't change the fact that it's political speech. If you have the government start saying, we believe you don't believe that particular position enough to be able to speak about it, and we have to take steps to ensure that we drill down to find out what you're really about, that's an enormous amount of intrusion of the government into the ability of people to communicate freely about issues and political candidates that they may care very deeply about. So I apologize, but I have to reject the premise of your question and say that when it comes to the First Amendment, the founders might have written the more the merrier with regard to political speech.
My comment to that is, you mentioned the Koch brothers. Who's the casino owner?
Sheldon Adelson.
Adelson. We know their names. We know who they are. I don't have a problem with them participating in this process to whatever amount their conscience dictates. I agree with that. I don't want to limit it. What I want to know is who they are. I think that's relevant to the conversation. What if we didn't know? What if super PACs didn't require full disclosure? I mean, one of the things, and it was talked about in the overview you'll read, is that in Citizens United, they say there needs to be a substantial relation to a sufficiently important government interest. Part of that government interest, the Supreme Court said, the public has an interest in knowing who is speaking about a candidate shortly before an election. Because the informational interest alone is sufficient to justify application, it is not necessary for the government to consider other interests. We know what the Supreme Court said in Citizens United. You need to know who that person is. If what was just described, if the payday lenders want to talk about health care, let them talk. But let's know that it's the payday lenders and $450,000 in that race or in two different races talking about health care. And let an informed voter or someone who may feel like they're being falsely accused or misrepresented be able to explain in their on their behalf what they think the context is of the attacks that they're or the criticisms that they're receiving. Because if you don't know that the Koch brothers are out there, if you don't know that Adelson's spending his money, if you don't know who's putting these dollars to make these charges or to influence these elections, and you have these beautiful flowery names of who these people are, but at the end of the day you don't know who they are really, I think it undermines this process. And then my question becomes, why don't I just fund all races that way? Why, if there's a cost-benefit analysis that says that disclosure is prohibitive, why would a PAC ever do this another day? Why not funnel get all the money in an anonymous way where no one has to worry about Adelson within the Jewish community has received incredible criticism for his political participation. National news. I don't know. I didn't know the guy's name before his participation. I didn't know he was Jewish and that his community was upset with him until the disclosures came out. That is a downside, and I agree to that. But if you're going to have two different tracks here in influencing campaigns, I don't know who would ever go through the cost-benefit analysis of disclosure and go through the transparent process we have if you can do it anonymously, or worse than anonymously, you can put fake names or different names to who you are. And so, again, it's got to be a level playing field. I want, as an American citizen, the same constitutional protections afforded to me in my race, in my attempts to communicate a position, as a nonprofit would have. So I just want the playing field to be level. I don't want to keep anybody out of that process.
Other questions?
If I may respond briefly to that before the next question. One of the things that I think is, concerning and has not been adequately addressed with regard to disclosure is, do people actually receive, Representative Hughes has repeatedly said, you know, I get to know that, eyes wide open. The information that people take from disclosure may not be of any use to them, and they may actually make decisions that are wrong. Are less informed because they have disclosure. For instance, if I lived in Representative Hughes' district and I had money to burn, I would probably donate to his campaign because I really like his position on school choice. But I'm disclosed on the Lieutenant Governor's website as having given the max to or given a large amount of money to Representative Hughes. Headline, Representative Hughes supported by dark money
advocate.
and the exact opposite is true. And so we're not, you know, it's a question of not only are you going to provide people with information, but is the information in a context and in a form that they're actually going to be able to use? And what we have right now is simply not worth the trouble that it causes, because it does not create a context, does not provide sufficient information what you have. There's lots of cues that people may find particularly interesting with regard to a donor. How about the donor's race, their sex, their sexual orientation? That's all stuff people may want to know about a political donor. Why doesn't the government require that? Why does it have to know their address and their employer? Those would make that information actually would allow people to make more informed decisions. And so there is a line people draw with regard to disclosure. It cannot be, if you participate in politics, you're essentially a private version of Kim Kardashian, and everybody knows exactly what you're doing all the time for every reason. Sorry.
Thank you. I'm Howard Stevenson, State Senator,
senator for Greg Hughes, actually, and he's my representative. And I'm also president of the Utah Taxpayers Association, hosting this this event along with the Hinckley Institute. I recall from my reading of history that the early elections in this nation were riddled with liquor and meals for voters to come in from their farms and to come and vote. And in one election, I believe it was somewhere in the terms of gallons per voter of liquor that was provided by the candidates. And one candidate, I'm trying to remember, was it Alexander Hamilton? I don't remember who it was. Refused to provide liquor and meals and lost the election and learned his lesson. In the next election, he did provide liquor. And that has led to why in this state and others, the liquor stores were required to be closed on election day. I say that to point out that elections have always been riddled with questionable kinds of motives. But it seems to me that the real problem here that we're trying to address, Representative Hughes and the Utah legislature through House Bill 43, and also you in IJ, through your defense of the First Amendment, both sides seem to think that we need to either fix the apathy and the ignorance of the voters by informing them more on Representative Hughes' side, or counting on them to plunge the depths by electing people who were funded from anonymous sources with nefarious motives and just suffer the consequences of the bad government which we would expect to follow from that, and then learn from it and fix it in succeeding elections. So I think we're struggling to try to fix the apathy and ignorance of voters, because it is rampant in this nation, I believe. I think you would both agree with that, mm-hmm. And it seems that that's the real problem here. IJ seems to think that we should just suffer the consequences of letting anonymous people influence elections in these ways, and ultimately the people will get mad enough that they will become less apathetic and learn from it. So any observations about...
Yeah, Senator, let me point out, that's what our pre-dental student asked us. How do you... What I think the question was is, and why I'm looking forward to this discussion, is how do you weigh these constitutional protections in an appropriate way? We all are entitled to them. And I understand some of the backlash when people step forward and get involved in political speech. How do you weigh that right to be involved with a process that isn't undermined or harmed in its outcome because you have different people playing by different rules? Every time you describe the barriers to and the consequences of disclosure, in my mind, I just keep thinking, but most of what we understand about the political process is working within that construct. And so if it's that bad, the real effort ought to be an even you know, a swath across and say that no one at any point ought to. But if you have it, and if you have those requirements, it's hard for me to argue that one should have a different set. So I would love to know what the answer to that is. How do you balance those constitutional protections with a process that you know who you're listening to, you have the relevant information? It is very difficult, and I will tell you from personal experience as a candidate, to have someone running against you and have people leveling charges at you that isn't the person who's looking to defeat you, and you can't confront them, and you can't talk about who they are. And the person who you're actually running against has no touch, has no involvement in the attacks that are going on. And let me tell you something. We, as a populace, have a healthy dose of skepticism about government. We should. We should be questioning it all, okay? When you tap into people's instincts about this healthy dose of skepticism, it's very easy for people to believe the politician's a crook. They're on the take. They're doing something wrong. There is something that you can tap into, and if you can't stand by it, if you can't say who you are and why you're saying that's the case, then I think you're manipulating a public that has a watchful eye on government, and you're using that instinct because you can never get to it. You can't get in front of them. And that's something we got to improve. And I'm open to how how to do that in a way that protects our constitutional liberties.
Well, ultimately, I think the problem here. Ultimately, what we're discussing here, I think, is a symptom instead of a disease. And I think that actually Representative Hughes may agree with me exactly what the disease is. The problem is not that we have anonymous people attempting to influence the outcome of elections or policy in order to provide benefits to themselves or burdens to others or to their opponents. The problem is we have a government that provides benefits to people and burdens to people in general. If we had a limited set of government, we had a limited government that did not have the ability to award benefits to politically influential people or burdens to people who have angered those in politics, a lot of this would become a moot issue. Unfortunately, what we have now is a government that has metastasized far beyond its constitutional reach and has gotten in the business of deciding who's going to win and who's going to lose in politics, in the economy, in any number of realms. And that was not our constitutional structure as it was initially envisioned. And I think it's one of the reasons why we struggle with these issues is because ultimately campaign finance reform is an attempt to keep a massive government from becoming little more than an oligarchy or a corrupt banana republic type of government, where the government's simply handing out favors and burdens based on who it does and does not like. The idea of the Constitution was to prevent that from happening, and we've moved away from that, and so we've had the answer to that, in my mind, is not to say, well, because we have a massive government now, we have to restrict the First Amendment so we don't become corrupt, is to move away. The proper response is we move away from the massive government.
Appreciate the dialogue that we've had today. I'd like to make just perhaps two concluding comments. As we spoke, Bill and Representative Hughes and I beforehand, Representative Hughes talked about an experience he had in Oregon where somebody leaned over to him and very quietly indicated, "I'm a Republican too," which is to say they felt uncomfortable letting the other people in their social circle know of that. And I think that illustrates, perhaps, some of the real problems that you can face for harassment if your political views are disclosed that you don't want to have disclosed. You're not comfortable with it. I had another thought. I don't remember what it is, but please.
Are we coming to an end here?
Yes.
So let me sum. I've thought about this as we've been discussing this issue. Political participation, and I got to tell you, if you're sitting in this room and you have any interest in politics, you've got to know it's not pain-free. What's being described in some ways is I would like to participate as much as my conscience dictates, and I don't want a backlash, and I don't want to have to feel intimidated or disagreed with or anything with my speech, with what I want to do in my participation. I will tell you that if you run for office, if you support someone who runs for office, the decisions they make, the saying is that friends come and go and enemies accumulate. Families feel the backlash of public service. People that get involved feel that. But this is the land of the free and home of the brave. I didn't see this country become what it is in an anonymous, in a backseat, I don't want to be known type of way. You've got to know that political participation is going to have its people that disagree, and you got to be involved, and you got to be ready to stand up for your rights and for the things that you passionately believe in. And when this person whispered to me, "I'm a conservative Republican," looking around like we're in—and I was joking—I felt like we're in Nazi-occupied Paris, you know. And these are like French resistance, you know, people. You know what it takes to stop whispering, to stand up for what you believe in, to get out there and say, "This is how I think things ought to be." Because that brings courage to the people around you as well, okay? And you don't have to whisper it, and you don't have to hide it. And you know what's going to happen? There's going to be opinions drawn from the way you speak, but that's what I think is the strongest fabric of our country, and what makes this country unique is that we get that chance, and we don't have a despot telling us how we're going to think or how we're going to act. we can stand up. But if you think that politics is a way to just do it and never have any of that reaction, it's not been my experience. My experience has been the opposite, that you will feel a pushback when you stand up for what you believe in. But I think that's a good thing.
And I guess my summation, very briefly, is that I agree with that, but that doesn't mean that the government should be in the business of facilitating your ability to be brave, forcing you to be brave. People can stand up and talk about what they believe in now. They don't need the government to be able to disclose to everybody their political beliefs, because ultimately the Constitution says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. Ultimately, what this does is it drives people from politics. And if we're looking to keep people from being apathetic, if we're looking for to keep people from being uninvolved or not participating in the decisions that affect their lives, disclosure is a very effective means to keep many small speakers, grassroots organizations, and volunteers from participating in politics.
Thank you.
Thanks.